The Daily Connect podcast, the voice of the RNIB Connect community.
Welcome to the Daily Connect podcast for Monday, the 20th of August. Your ears do not deceive you, my friends. Stephen Scott is not in the chair today. He is on holiday for the week, so for the next five Daily Connect podcasts, you'll be listening to me, Chris Wallace. I hope that's not too traumatic for you, but we have all the same fantastic features that you would expect from the Daily Connect. And today we will check in with Liz Frankland, a blind blogger from Travelize who has recently taken a bold step to become a life coach. She'll be telling us about the training and giving you an offer you might not want to refuse. We also have another story about those lovely guide dogs today in our continuing series, Pause for Thought. Today we meet Shan from Cymru and the guide dogs that have meant so much in her life, Arnie and Yuri. Also, we'll be finding out how another eye condition affects the person living with it in our How I See series. Today we'll hear from Rachel, who has retinitis pigmentosa. And available now is the Opus radio from the charity, the British Wireless for the Blind. We'll be hearing about all its fantastic features, which include DAB and Bluetooth. But first of all, we are taking to the heights to find out what you would do for charity. Have you ever considered doing something that not only raised some much needed funds, but also gave you the opportunity to score something off your bucket list? RNIB's Big Jump in September is one such occasion, where you're invited to skydive to raise money for RNIB. Those who take part will jump en masse on the 23rd of September to mark the end of National Eye Health Week 2018. Alan Russell has been chatting to Imran Akhtar to find out what it's like for a blind person, who is scared of heights no less, to take on a parachute jump. Alan started by asking exactly why Imran would willingly throw himself out of a perfectly good plane.
It's something that's always been in the back of my mind. I've always loved speed when I love roller coasters and that kind of thing. But on the other hand, I am actually scared of heights. It's weird because on a roller coaster, you're strapped in. You know nothing can go wrong. But even now, when I'm standing at the edge of a train station platform and I look down, I'm a little bit uneasy. I feel myself gravitating towards it. It was a strange thing to do. And my wife was like, nope, you're not doing it. You're definitely not doing it. But I managed to talk her around because it is once in a lifetime thing. You hear about people doing it and how amazing it is. And I thought that if I can just get over the mental block of doing it, I knew it would be great.
So tell me about the training and the day. How does it all work?
You're called up quite early, about 8 o'clock in the morning, and there's lots of people there to do the skydive. It's probably about 8 or 9 people in all. And it's a waiting game. It's a very, very long waiting game because obviously it depends on the weather. If there's a lot of cloud cover or it's raining, then you can't go up. Obviously, safety is the number one concern. So I was there and I hope I'm not putting a dampener on it, but on the first day, I didn't actually get to do the skydive. There were clouds all day and I was waiting and waiting and it just didn't happen for me. So I actually went home with my tail between my legs. But then a month later, I went back again and went through all the training. They show you the plane and how to jump, and more importantly, how to land, because that's how most injuries happen. So they actually recorded you saying that we've been taught how to land. So after the training, then again, it was just a matter of waiting. And I was getting a little bit nervous because the clouds were gathering and it was getting late in the day and only two other people had done the jump. So I'd resigned myself to it not happening. But then over the tannoy, as they said, could Imran Akhtar please come to the office? And I'm not joking, my heart jumped into my mouth. It was, I was like, oh no, this is the thing I've been waiting for. Now it's actually staring me in the face. I thought, oh no, this is not good. But so I got strapped in and we went up in this tiny, tiny little plane. It was me and one other girl was jumping. It took about 4 or 5 minutes to get to the altitude, and the strangest thing was, I mean, after going up, I was actually fine. But when it really did hit me about what's happening here is the girl actually jumped before me. So she was just sitting at the edge of the plane, and then she was just gone. It's like she jumped into oblivion. I thought, where'd she go? I didn't know where she went. And then I thought, no, this isn't right. There's something that's not natural. But then the guy scooshed me over to the opening. So I was just hanging on for dear life. I took my position that he told me to take, and then he did actually push me out because I know they could have done it otherwise. So then we went out, and then, oh my God. Well, the only really scary bit is the half second when you're just about to jump out. But then after that, I am not joking, it's the best experience ever. The free fall was about 20 seconds, and I just wished it was about 20 minutes. It was that exhilarating. It's hard to explain it. It doesn't really feel like you're falling. It feels like you're in suspended animation, and you don't feel the speed. It's really hard to explain, but you just, it feels like you're floating down. You can hear the wind rushing around your head, but it doesn't feel like you're actually falling. So when the parachute went up, then we got down in about 4 or 5 minutes, and yeah, it was, when I got to the ground, I just wanted to go straight back up and do it again. It was that great.
And if you're ready for the thrill of a lifetime, why not take on the skydive for RNIB for an unforgettable experience? You can register to join the big jump at www.rnib.org.uk/the-big-jump.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
Now, Liz Frankland has gone on many adventures. She is a blind blogger for Travel Eyes, which has taken her around the globe. Recently, she sought to conquer something new, a career as a life coach, and now she wants to help you. It hasn't been easy, though. Her first obstacle was an intensive course with the Christy Whitman Academy. Here's Liz with her reaction to the course.
It was hard work, but it was well worth it. It was no ordinary life coaching course either. It was built around the philosophy of what is called law of attraction, which basically means that, in effect, you are responsible for everything in your life. For whatever is around you, you have created in one way or another. The good news about that is that through coaching, you can actually change that. You can actually change the way you think and change the decisions that you make in order to change the way your life is. The job of a coach isn't to teach or advise. We're not consultants in any way. We're there really to guide people to come to their own conclusions and their own realizations about what it is that they need to do. So we're not skilled in either relationship counseling or career advice or anything like that, but we're skilled as listeners and to ask the right questions of the client so that they can come to their own realizations of what it is that they need to do to move forward and change their life, really. It was a year's course, and it was phenomenally hard work. There were 36 classes that we had to attend online, because this is like all over the world, so it's all done online. And then we had to do 70 coaching hours to qualify. So you had to get people who would actually be prepared to be coached by you to actually get the qualification. And there were 6 written assignments, and there were 8 audio assignments. The Christy Whitman Academy, who I did the course through, sends out videos and such like throughout the week anyway that are sort of tips and tricks about how to actually change your life, the sort of things that we would do in a coaching session. And people pick up these videos because they pick them up on the internet and they'll listen for a while and think, oh, that seems quite interesting stuff. Christy Whitman always puts on the end of her emails, if you would like further help in implementing these kind of things, then please get in touch with the Coaching Academy. And we've always got trainee coaches who are quite happy to give you sessions for free. So didn't actually earn any money doing this, but there were actually people who were put forward by the Coaching Academy who wanted, you know, some sort of coaching. Initially, it scared me to death. You know, you think, can I do this? And of course, we were coaching before we'd ever qualified, before we'd ever finished the course. So you didn't have all the tools and information that I've got now. And it was quite scary. And you think, can I come up with the right kind of processes and the right kind of ideas for them to work on? And initially, it's really scary. But as I say, people who look for coaching tend to be really quite committed to actually doing something about their lives. And if you manage to just give them a little bit of relief from whatever it is that they're struggling with. There was a girl who was trying to set up her own business, and she wasn't managing to make the progress that she really wanted to make. And when we actually talked, we began to realise that it had something to do with when she was growing up and her parents just not being very comfortable with the fact that she wasn't very conventional, let's say. And she realised that she had a lot of pain attached to the fact that her parents just didn't understand her, didn't encourage her in the way she wanted to go, and that she needed to do some healing around the fact that her parents didn't really give her the support that she needed. And some of this is about actually forgiving the past and moving forward from those things that hurt you, you know, in your earlier life, so that you can move on. Because people don't move on, and they don't always realise that they've actually got some pain that they're just not dealing with. So coaching can actually bring that to the surface as well. It doesn't have to be an earth-shattering change, but if it actually improves their situation only a little bit, then that, in some instances, is what that is all they were really wanting at that moment. So people are usually generally quite appreciative. So you feel more encouraged then, you know, once people have said, well, you know, that really worked for me. I'm really glad that we went through this particular issue. I'm really glad that I went away and did this particular process that you suggested. I think it's always going to be a little bit scary having a new client because you don't know anything about them. But once you start to get to know people, it's like anything else. You get on with people. If you like people generally, as I do, you become quite comfortable quite quickly, I think. The people who a coach is there to help are the people who are committed to making those changes in their life. If you're not actually that committed, then we can't really help you. You've got to be in a position where you really want to do something different. Well, if people want to get in touch with me, I'm more than willing to have a free session. They don't have to actually pay up front. They can have a free session and see whether it's for them. It's liz.frankland, that's FRANKLAND, at yahoo.co.uk. It's surprising how very simple things can actually make quite a big difference.
The Daily Connect podcast.
It's time for our continuing series, Pause for Thought. Shan Healy is the Mobility Team Service User Representative for Guide Dogs Cymru. Here she talks about her guide dogs, Arnie and Yuri.
In March, unfortunately, my guide dog of 7.5 years, Arnie, unfortunately had to retire because he began to feel very stressed and was suffering from arthritis. And I noticed that he was not always happy in harness, and they came in and assessed him. And it was quite an emotional roller coaster because I'd hoped he was only just 9, and I'd really hoped that he would get a bit further down in his career before he had to retire. So it was a bit shock, and it was a bit immediate as well, because when I got assessed, which is what guide dogs do, they come in and they look at you working together, and they almost made the decision there and then that he needed to retire. And they literally told me that he was only working because he wanted to work for me and be with me. And that was really, really difficult. But at that moment, yes, we handed over his harness. We had a few speaker roles to do first, which they allowed me just to take him for those. And then he officially retired when we finished our last talk, which was for a college. And then that was it. His harness was gone. And then I was really lucky. It was only a couple of months after that, after picking up my cane. And again, I had guide dog support again. They came out. I had retraining with my cane just to keep me going. My world began to shrink already. Any guide dog owners know this happens. Getting your confidence back with a cane is quite a challenge. And then fortunately, Yuri came along quicker than we had expected, because unfortunately his original match didn't work out, not because of Yuri and not because of the other person. As all guide dog owners know, there are times when having a guide dog owner, being a guide dog owner, is the right thing, and sometimes when it just doesn't fit with your life. And it's a difficult decision to make, that sometimes a guide dog isn't the right thing. And for the person he originally trained with, she made the decision that although he was a really good guide dog, it wasn't the right thing in her life at the time. And that's a really brave thing to do. So he was sort of in limbo. I was in limbo. And they said to me, Sian, this dog really does match your life really well. I mean, it's a complete coincidence that he would fit in with you, the things you like doing. He walks at a good pace for you. Would you like to just, you know, see how you get on? And within a couple of days, because of the strange circumstances, he was living with me and we were training quite quickly. I had a few blips about, was it the right thing to do? Was it too soon? Because of, you know, you go through a bit of grief. A physical and emotional grief when your guide dog retires is quite a difficult stage. And then for a new puppy to almost come bouncing into your life. And I mean, I am really, really fortunate. I was able to keep Arnie. I have family up the road. He goes to doggy daycare with my mum and dad, so his grandparents look after him. I've got my husband who walks him. I was able to keep him. So I was really, really grateful, because a lot of people have the difficult decision that they can't keep them. And guide dogs always look at the welfare of the dog first. And they came and assessed the provision I'd made for him to stay with me, and they said he was okay to stay. So I'm lucky. I've now got two dogs at home. One is a pet dog who is aging, and then this new puppy who's come into our lives, bouncing through, and has picked up the harness and has picked up my life. And I'm back out as busy as ever, with restrictions, because when you start a new partnership with a guide dog, you are under restrictions. I can't do fundraising and things like that until about 6 months to a year, whereas I was doing a lot of fundraising and talks and things like that with Arnie. But I can still do the things I love. I can still go to art class. I can come to the CIB and do my volunteering with a museum. So Yuri is on full mode, really. And in a few months to be able to do that, I am so grateful and privileged, really, to be a guide dog owner and have this freedom that he's given me.
How do Yuri and Arnie get along?
Well, luckily, they get along really well, because that was one of my biggest concerns. You know, if they don't get on, that's going to be a really difficult decision. Do I send the new working dog back, or, you know, we'll have to find new provisions for Arnie? As it happened, the first few days, they just ran around like fools. And I thought, oh my goodness, how am I going to manage two dogs? And they're not small dogs either. They're both Labrador retrievers. One is a goldy colour, Arnie, very golden, very retrievery. And then Yuri, my new dog, is very white. And again, a Labrador retriever, but he looks more like a Labrador. But they're both quite large dogs. So they're both running around my house and my garden like mad fools, playing and having fun. I thought, oh gosh, am I going to be able to cope with this? But as it happened, they've settled down really well. And they cuddle up together. They're very close and they're both getting on really well. I am so lucky that they're actually good company for each other. In fact, Arnie seems to be far more settled. Seems to be so much better for having Yuri around. Because he started getting stressed even in the car, he'd pant and I'd get anxious and squeak and things. And now when they both go in the car, I think he also knows they're going to go somewhere nice together and he's not going to need to work. He's quiet in the car and settles next to Yuri really well. And he's even sleeping better because he was beginning to get a bit anxious in the night. So I'm lucky that it's really, really fortunate that this has happened to me in this way. And I've got to enjoy it, because all guide dog owners know we're on a difficult path. We don't know what's around the corner. We don't know the health of our dogs. We don't know what could be next with our own health or with the dog's health. So I am really enjoying, you know, the freedom that, and the independence I've got at the moment, and I'm making the most of it.
The Daily Connect podcast.
This year marks RNIB's 150th anniversary. To celebrate, we've been asking the blind and partially sighted community for their stories and experiences of sight loss. We will be sharing these stories over the coming months to document the changes we've seen in the last 150 years. Today, it's the story of Annette. She says, My eyes are open now, and what do I see? Awakened from darkness into light, born again with new sight, a different world with all its immediate challenges for me. Ready to embrace and greet them each and every day, now I can see what the world has to offer. My new rose-tinted lenses, which brings everything closer, brighter, and into sharper focus. I have a vision, and I have pledged to do 4 kilt walks commemorating the 150th anniversary of RNIB in Glasgow, Aberdeen, Dundee, and Edinburgh. I view this as my pilgrimage to explore Scotland with a fresh pair of eyes. Through living, breathing, and preparing for the kilt walks, I have been presented with an opportunity to be healthier and happier. It's a milestone in my life, and I want to give something back. Who knows what the future holds, but I'm trying to find my true path in life. Walking. That was Annette's story. And if you're interested in sharing your story, please complete the submission form at rnib.org.uk/150stories.
The Daily Connect podcast.
RNIB's #HowIsee campaign is a really innovative way of helping all of us better understand vision loss. Now, lots of you have been sharing your stories on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter, and of course right here on RNIB Connect Radio. Here, Rachel has some interesting thoughts about her sight condition, retinitis pigmentosa.
So my sight condition is retinitis pigmentosa, which is one of the retinal dystrophies. It means that kind of slowly the retina sort of dies off, stops working. And there are various kind of forms of it, but mine presented, which is a quite common presentation, with early night blindness, inability to function in low and dark kind of light levels, and then the gradual erosion of my peripheral vision, leaving me with a little patch of kind of tunnel vision, I suppose you'd call it, at this point in time. I think my sight is around 20 degrees at the moment and is very likely to get a lot worse from there. I find that trying to run after 2 very small children who are always out of my central vision is quite hard, often standing and calling for my child, and I then find out he's standing directly in front of me. So taking a long time to get out of the house, finding it quite hard to go places with them unless it's really obvious that they are contained. I'd find it difficult to run after them, to locate them if they were, you know, kind of off just playing in a kind of open area. I find that when I'm wheeling a pram, it's not very easy to use a cane, so I'm quite reliant on, you know, going quite slowly with the pram and kind of feeling my way. I'm also aware of the amount of confusion that it causes when I got my children at nursery using a pram and then, you know, come back using my cane, and people probably thinking, you know, what on earth is that lady doing? But generally just having to take a bit longer to do things, finding it quite emotionally difficult and stressful, and just kind of an added layer really on most things. There's friends that I've had a chance to explain to, and the most of them are fine with it, but sometimes they'll see me with a pram and they'll come up to me and say, oh, you're cured then. And I'll say, well, no one's come up with a cure as yet, because they're confused by, you know, well, where's your cane gone? And then you've got, you know, strangers who might, some people that might see me quite regularly, people that work locally, and I walk past them. And I've had some comments from them, people shouting and coming up to me and kind of challenging me, you know, what can you see? I thought you were blind. And so a bit of that going on, which can be very unsettling. I think the casual friends and people that, you know, see me all the time but don't know me, I think that they are probably the people that take up most of my headspace. And what I try and do is, you know, put it as far to the back of my mind as I can. But I suppose there's always a part of me that's thinking, you know, if I go on this route, who am I likely to see? Am I taking my cane? Am I using my cane consistently? Or are there times when I'm going to have to run after my children? So I'll suddenly go from a cane user to a, you know, fundamentally what looks like a sighted, although rather bumbling, sighted person. Am I going into the centre of town, in which case I'm going to need the cane absolutely, or am I in the quieter outskirts, in which case I can do without it? What messages do those send? Should I be completely honest about if someone, you know, points out to me something? Should I just take the help even if I don't need it? All these things just constantly kind of go round and round in my head, and I'm kind of trying really hard to just let them be and notice them and let them go. But it is an extra layer of energy and questioning of myself and others that I'm aware goes on. It feels as if there's not much out there for people like me who are well, in some lights are partially sighted and other lights are completely blind. So it feels like to be able to talk about my experiences and be valued and heard and to be able to communicate what's happening for me and to hear other stories. You know, I've got an idea about what living with other sight conditions might be, but I can't really know. And people who don't know anything about these sight conditions to maybe just take a pause and just ask, really ask, do you need any help? You know, that's all we're asking for. And to give us the benefit of the doubt. I doubt there's anyone that goes around using a cane or a dog that is, you know, is doing it just for a bit of fun. You know, it's a big change to your life. It's a massive shift just how complex some of the challenges are for people. Retinitis pigmentosa has forced me to consider, I suppose, what it is to be human, what it is to, you know, we will all hopefully grow old. We will all encounter illness and potentially disability in our lives. You know, the older that we get, it's caused me to think really carefully about what's important in life, who I want to be as a person, what kind of values I want to live by. And I think, you know, even if those things have come around naturally, I think certainly having retinitis pigmentosa has forced those questions earlier and led me to a greater clarity. So although it does have a lot of difficulties and, you know, the thought that I might not see my children grow up is, you know, heartbreaking. But at the same time, I am aware of how it has sharpened the value that I place in life as well.
The Daily Connect podcast.
And finally on the podcast today, Charity, the British Wireless for the Blind Fund, has been providing radios to blind and partially sighted people for 90 years. Since they are celebrating their anniversary this year, they have also decided to introduce a brand new device for people to enjoy. The Opus has DAB and DAB+, as well as FM radio, and is already available to qualifying candidates on free loan or to buy. Roland Myers is here to tell us all about it.
Coinciding with the 90th anniversary of British Wireless for the Blind Fund providing radios for vision impaired people to buy and on free loan, the charity has now introduced the latest in its range of bespoke radios and audio players designed specifically for ease of use by those with little or no sight. Called the Opus, the portable digital radio offers DAB and DAB+, and FM RDS radios, but also Bluetooth audio streaming, USB recording, and playback. Some of the other features it boasts are a liquid crystal display with zoom, 10 one-touch radio presets, and built-in battery charging. And its design, like their other two radios, the multi-audio format Concerto 2 and the Duet Dual Radio, has the familiar charcoal grey casing with bright yellow tactile controls. We spoke to David Beard from the charity about the new Opus, and David started by comparing it with their Concerto 2 radio, CD and cassette player.
We've heard one predominant thing about the current piece of equipment that we have, which is Concerto 2, and that's the size of it. So what we've actually done here is actually delivered a unit that's half the size of Concerto 2, and it's half the weight. In doing that, we've obviously removed a couple of elements of Concerto 2. And that's the CD and the tape element. And we just come back to a radio that has USB function.
Finding the stations you want on any radio can be difficult for someone with very limited sight. Are there easy ways of tuning into the stations you want and hanging on to the stations that you want if you might want to listen to them on a regular basis?
Of course. We can never get away from the fact that the whole process of setting a station up is visual. Although we can always listen out for obviously the station that's being played to us to determine where we are. But once we get it set up, because we have five presets, it's just as simple as pressing that button 1, 2, 5 on the top of the radio.
Right, so you've got buttons 1 to 5 on the front of the panel, and there's a small screen behind that. Does that screen give necessary and useful information, or is it an additional add-on, if you like, for people who've got usable residual vision?
So the screen tells us everything about the station that we're currently tuned to, and all of the data that's coming from the station about what the song that's just played and other information as well that's coming there.
You said it's a USB player. Right in the middle at the top in the centre, you've got the USB socket. Will it sense that you've put a USB stick in there? Will it know and start playing? How do you control the sound on the USB?
On the new Opus, we have 4 selection buttons in the top left. T for tuner, U for USB, and we just press that button for USB. It will then turn it into USB mode, and we then put the USB in, and it will obviously tell us how many tracks and everything are on there, and then we just press play and it starts playing.
And what sort of loudspeaker has it got?
This has got a left and right channel. It's a full stereo speaker. This is a Roberts player. You'll know that it's made by Roberts once you turn it on, and it has a fantastic tone.
And there's a headphone socket on it as well. Now, what new functions has Opus got that previous radios of yours haven't had?
On the old Concerto, we would always record everything back to tape. So we're now recording to USB. So this unit has full record. It will record from the radio. It will record from a microphone internal in the unit or one that you plug in. And in addition to that, it's got Bluetooth. So you can connect your smartphone and use this as an amplified speaker. And again, you can record all of that. I'm told that if you plug the right things in the right places, you can even turn this into a karaoke machine. It has an aux function on it. So you can actually get that output playing from the speakers themselves.
So have you aimed to make this a kind of all-in-one unit, bearing in mind that cassette is not with us anymore and CDs are possibly not that common?
For those that want to still use tape and CD, Concerto's still there. We've got it for a while. It's not going anywhere at the moment. But this unit, for those that are using USB, brings it bang up to date. There's no sliders, there's no belts, there's no drives. That means there's no heavy batteries that go into it. There's no weight to it.
And I guess we must finally talk about what is almost a trademark of all your radios, which is the high colour contrast, the sort of charcoal grey background and the yellow markers, which highlight all the controls. I see that they're all very different shapes and sizes. That's obviously very intentional.
Yes, totally. So even down to the fact that the arrangement of the four function buttons spells Tuba, T-U-B-A.
Yeah, that's tuner, USB, Bluetooth and AUX. So you select which of those you want the radio to actually be using, what you're listening to.
Yes. And all throughout the process, although ultimately this radio won't talk to you, it has a number of useful and helpful beeps to tell you that a preset's been stored, or a beep to tell you that you're recording on the USB. There's obviously ascending and descending tones, obviously, for when we're searching for radio stations. So there's lots of useful indicators and helpers in there. There's clearly a number of buttons on it. We're not going to get away from that. But we have tuning tone volumes and playing tone volumes and a volume button. And then once we get outside of the tuning up and tuning down and the select button, we've only then got the presets and the play, stop, fast forward, pause and record for the USB left. So at the first instance, it looks as though it is quite busy, but it is quite minimalist in the number of buttons that it has to just do exactly what it needs to do.
And I suppose significantly, with a few exceptions, every button is different in tactile terms. It either has the number 1, 2, 3, 4 or 5 on it, or it has a letter on it, or a cross, or an arrow. So can this be operated without sight?
Most certainly, yeah. The whole purpose, obviously, of those buttons, if we go right back to the first radio that had Braille on it, these are not Braille symbols, but these are recognised symbols that the manual will describe even. So when you're listening to the manual, it will tell you that it's a raised symbol with a hollow middle, or it's a raised symbol with a filled in middle, to determine which shape it is. And like I say, all of the buttons are there, but they're all away from each other. So the presets are nowhere near the play, stop and pause buttons. The tuner buttons are over on the right out of the way. The function buttons are over on the top left. And there's good finger spacing between all of them. So you're not going to press a button you believe you're pressing whilst pressing one to the left. There's no room to do that.
Now, as with all British Wireless's radios and audio players, they're available on free loan to any registrable blind or partially sighted person who meets certain criteria, and you can contact the charity to find out about those and whether you qualify for a free radio on loan. Separately, the charity's trading arm, BWBF Direct, sells their radios, and the new Opus costs £190. That price excludes VAT, which is not paid on this adapted radio if it's bought by a registered blind or partially sighted person or by someone on their behalf. And for more information about the Opus radio audio player or any other radios and players available from British Wireless, you can phone them on 01 622 754 01622757. That's 01622754757. Or they may be emailed at info@blind.org.uk.
The Daily Connect Podcast.
That's it for another Daily Connect podcast. Do join me again tomorrow. We have a fantastic Connect conversation coming up. Sunset Melody's Gary Moritz will be chatting to Connie Chu about her music, her fashion career, and her albinism. We'll be wanting some of your views on how albinism affects your life, or if some people in your job or your everyday life are completely naive about how your albinism affects your eyesight. So lots to talk about tomorrow. We'll also be hearing from Nikki Kelly, who's telling us what's going on in the Birmingham area. So tune in tomorrow. You can either download the podcast just after 5 p.m. on Tuesday, or tune in live, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, from 10 a.m. until 12 noon. Thanks for listening.
The Daily Connect Podcast.